Good morning. I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 9:06 on Tuesday, May 28th. Last week, the Chicago School Board decided to close 50 public schools they say aren't being fully utilized. They say it's one way to save about $438 million over the next 10 years in the face of a $1 billion budget deficit. The decision came despite fierce protests from parents and teachers who are concerned about safe and easy access to public education for their children. And most of the closings are in low-income neighborhoods affecting mostly African-American and Hispanic students. We're wondering this hour if this action concerns you. Might it be the start of a trend across the country? We ask you to join the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. Our guest this hour is Diane Ravitch, an education historian and research professor of education at New York University. She was the U.S. Assistant Secretary of Education under President George H.W. Bush, and she joins us this hour. Good morning, Diane.
Good morning, Cynthia.
Thanks so much for joining us today. I saw on your blog last week that you said that last Wednesday will go down as a day in infamy of infamy in Chicago in the history of American education. Why do you say that?
Well, first of all, because the decision to intentionally close so many public schools at one time is unprecedented. I've been searching through the history to try to find out if there's anything like it, and the only mass closure I was able to find was when the schools in some counties, like Prince Edward County in Virginia, were closed to avoid desegregation. And that was simply a ruse because they were then sent to a private academy, and the schools remained closed for years, and then they reopened. So there is nothing in the history of public education that is comparable to what happened in Chicago, where the school board voted to close en masse 48 or 50 schools. So the number keeps shifting because some of them aren't right. really schools, and some of them are two schools wrapped in one. But there's nothing like it. It's just a wipeout of a major sector of that whole school system.
So can you help me understand, as I was doing my research for this program, 100 schools have already closed since 2001 in Chicago.
Right.
So is the unprecedented nature of this decision just simply the fact that 50 schools are closing all at once?
Well, that's certainly the case. There has never been a mass closure all at once. And New York City has closed even more schools than Chicago. But I think it's real important for people to understand that the idea of closing schools to improve them is a ridiculous idea and never happened in our history up until the last decade. This is all about federal education policy. First of all, it's about No Child Left Behind, which said that if the school is low performing and doesn't improve, one of the ways to remedy the situation is to close the school. That's in federal law. Hmm. And then you have Arne Duncan, who actually was the first superintendent to say, I'm going to make schools better and provide better education by closing schools. And he closed three schools in 2002. And then in 2004, he announced his personal plan and strategy, he and Mayor Richard Daley, and their plan was called Renaissance 2010. And the theory behind Renaissance 2010 was close 60 low-performing schools and open 100 new schools. The results of that obviously haven't worked because we're in 2014 and Renaissance 2010 passed a while back, and we have yet to see a renaissance in Chicago. In fact, the greatest irony of Chicago is that the three schools that were the first to be closed by Arne Duncan have now been closed by Rahm Emanuel for a second time.
What have we learned from the previous closings? Are we actually saving money in the face of these budget deficits?
It actually doesn't save money to close schools because, first of all, the kids still need teachers. They still need accommodations. And the city of Chicago is going to be putting a lot of new money. I read in there was a wonderful piece done by NPR in Chicago, WBEZ, in which they went through each of the school system's justifications and said, it's not true. It's not going to save money because the system is going to have to now plow that $240 million into upgrading the new facilities or creating new facilities for the children that are displaced. Now, the figure that's usually bandied about is displaced children is 30,000, but according to the NPR story, in Chicago, it won't be 30,000. It's closer to 50,000. The number they used was 46,000. So this is just unprecedented that at the end of the school year, you close down schools. Some of the kids don't know where they're going to go. Mm-hmm. And many of them will be sent far from their neighborhood. And this is part of a national pattern that Arne Duncan started, that No Child Left Behind made as a legal remedy, and that Race to the Top considers a way of reforming the schools.
How many students are we talking about? How many are being displaced by the closings?
Well, the Chicago Public Schools says it's 30,000. And as I said before, the independent researchers at NPR, WBEZ, say it's 46,000. And neither of those numbers take into account the incoming kindergartners. So it could be even more than 46,000.
Mm-hmm. And where are they expected to go to school now?
Well, some of them know and some of them don't know. I mean, the funny thing is that one of the reasons for the closing is supposedly that there's been this dramatic drop in enrollment, but that's actually not true. The enrollment has gone down by 6,000 students in the last, since 2010. So that hardly gives a reason to close the schools of 50,000 children. What the school board is engaged in is encouraging privatization. What they will end up doing is sending many of these kids, they'll authorize more charter schools, which are privately managed, and they'll send them to charter schools as many as they can, or as many as the charter schools want. And they will, the Chicago school system is on a path of handing off as many kids as they can to the private sector, which is what the underlying rationale is.
And we see some trends along those lines across the country and even in Wisconsin. I'm wondering whose eyes are on Chicago right now and who's got a stake in seeing how this all turns out.
Well, the problem is that when you look at things like school closings and call them reform, you're talking about, first of all, a failed policy, because clearly Chicago's been doing this since 2002. No Child Left Behind was started in 2002. Bloomberg in New York City has been doing exactly the same since 2002, and no one would look at these cities' schools and say that either that Chicago or New York has improved dramatically. So this is not school reform. What this is privatization. And what we know about privatization is that it's not school reform either, because the charter schools, by and large, and this is true in Minneapolis, it's true in New Jersey, it's true in every city I've looked at, the charter schools mostly exclude the kids with the highest needs. They don't want English language learners. They don't want the kids with the severe disabilities. And so we're on our way to developing a dual school system. The charter system, which can pick and choose its students and kick them out if they don't do well. And a public school system, doors open to all, that has to take the kids that the charters don't want.
Mm. Well, some would say, though, that by offering these options to the disadvantaged, or that might actually serve a greater need and help them. Do you disagree with that, or are you concerned about their access to education?
Well, let me say that I disagree with that rationale, because what is really happening, and we see this in places like New Orleans and others where there are a lot of charters, New York City this is true, and I suspect it's true in Chicago as well, is that charters choose, not the people. If a parent has a student with a disability, he or she will have a hard time getting them into a charter school, because charter schools don't want them. They'll say, well, we don't really have the resources to handle your child, and so they don't get in there. So it's not the parents or the children that are choosing. It's the schools that are choosing. And I don't see this as a big blow. I mean, privatization never helps advance equity. Privatization means turning public dollars over to the private sector, and the private sector looks first of all at cutting cost, and this is why they prefer inexperienced teachers like Teach for America, and these are young kids who are very bright and idealistic, and they come for 2 years or 3 years, and then they're gone. So then the school doesn't have to worry about pension costs and expensive teachers, because they keep having this high turnover of young people at the low end of the scale.
I was just reading about Wisconsin's school choice program that's been in place for a while now, and new data say that students in the private schools in Milwaukee are actually not scoring as well in math and reading as they had hoped. Can you talk about why that might be? If schools are able to choose who their students are, and as you say, get rid of the students that aren't performing well, why are the test scores turning out to be lower than expected?
Well, this is one of the most curious puzzles about the school choice movement, and that is that the voucher schools can kick kids out, and this is true in all of the voucher programs. The charter schools find ways to either counsel kids out, or they hold them back so often that they leave and go back to public school. So they end up creaming, and this is happening in city after city, wherever there are charters, and in the few places where there are vouchers, I know, for example, in Milwaukee, the Justice Department just issued a warning to the state of Wisconsin saying you've got to make the voucher schools stop excluding children with special needs. So despite the fact that they're excluding children with special needs and that they're limiting the children who barely speak English, their scores are no better. And the only reason I can think of is that there are better teachers in the public schools than there are in these, either the charter schools or in the voucher schools, because in many states, probably most of them, the charter schools and voucher schools don't have to have certified teachers. Mm-hmm. And I think it's in a profession like education, it's better to have people with experience, it's better to have people with certification than to have young people with high ideals and high expectations who don't know what to do.
So in your mind, what would be a better approach to these, to improving these schools and improving their performance as an alternative to closing them?
Well, smaller class size. And in fact, one of the ironies of the Chicago situation is they're going to increase class size across the city. But the research on class size is very powerful, that the children who benefit the most are low-income kids, minority kids, particularly black kids, and that it just makes sense that if kids come in and they have greater needs and they have not had a rich vocabulary in their early years because they didn't have pre-K, they do need smaller classes. If you have a kindergarten with 30 kids or a first and second or third grade with 30 kids, the teacher's not going to be able to give them individual attention, and they do need individual attention. They need help. So the most sensible way to help, if you really care about reform and helping the kids who are the neediest, would be to insist on reduced class size in the early grades and making sure that every school has the arts and doesn't spend an inordinate amount of time on testing and test prep, because that has a tendency to just turn kids off and bore them to tears. And we're now, as a nation, devoted to testing as the purpose of education, which is insane.
We're talking with Diane Ravitch today. She's a research professor of education at New York University and an education historian, former U.S. Assistant Secretary of Education under President George H.W. Bush. And she's talking with us about the decision last week to close about 50 public schools in the Chicago school system. And we're wondering, what do you think the answer is for public schools that are underperforming? Is closing them the answer? Increasing their budgets? Making changes to the way we teach, smaller class sizes, as Diane suggests. Please share your solutions at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org. I'm Cynthia Schuster, filling in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking this hour about the decision last week by the Chicago School Board to close 50 public schools as a means of saving about $438 million in the face of a $1 billion budget deficit. We're wondering if that's the right approach. Certainly many public school districts are facing budget crunches, and this is an issue that many people have their eyes on. We're talking today with Diane Ravitch, research professor of education at New York University and an education historian. We also are accepting your calls at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. Diane, before the break, you mentioned the emphasis on standardized testing as a way to evaluate schools, but are we doing too much of that testing?
I think that parents are beginning to get it across the country. Parents, teachers have known this for a long time. Testing is not teaching. And right now we're in a vortex of testing, where it has gone so far over the top that teachers will tell you that they spend about a quarter of their time preparing for testing and testing. That's all time that should be used for teaching kids how to read, teaching kids mathematics, and instead they're testing them. The tests just are not that valuable that kids should be incessantly tested. The move right now across the country is to tie everything to testing, to tie teacher tenure to testing, to tie their salary to test scores, to close schools based on test scores. So the tests have become all important. And because they are so important, they determine whether your school lives or dies. Of course, teachers are now teaching to the test, and many districts have interim tests and preparation tests and then the final test. And then when it's over, the kids don't have any interest in school at all because they say, we've already done a state test. Why bother? It's really out of hand.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I'm curious, too, with the Chicago scenario, they cited population loss in many of these schools as a reason to close them down. And I'm wondering how testing can even be a factor in, when one of your issues is population loss.
Well, I don't think they've had, according to the data, they really have not had a big population loss. And in fact, what they're also doing is at the same time that they're closing all of these schools that are public schools, they're also opening new charter schools. So one of the reasons for what they call a population loss is that they have opened so many charter schools. There are now something like 400,000 kids in the public schools, and 75,000 kids are in charter schools. And that 400, though, includes the 75,000 in the charters, although I would not consider charter schools to be public schools. They're just private schools that contract to get money from the state. So I think that one of the reasons there's been a loss of enrollment in the public schools is because Chicago has been determined to open more and more charter schools, and the charter schools do not outperform the public schools.
So how do they measure whether the schools were underutilized?
They used a measure in which they said every classroom should have 30 students. Mm-hmm. They did not take into account that students who are in special education are never in a classroom with 30 students. Some of them are in classrooms with only 5 or 8 or 10 children because of the severity of their needs. So if you assume that every classroom has 30 students, which is a wrong assumption, then you're considering schools underutilized that are, in fact, fully utilized. It was a very skewed way of doing the count. They wanted to close the schools, and so they came up with a formula to do it.
Well, part of the story here is a conflict between teacher unions and the mayor of Chicago, and there are certainly similar issues here in Wisconsin, too. Where do unions fit into this story of school closings?
Well, you know, the union has been extremely proactive in Chicago. They went on strike last September, and there are many people who believe that one of the reasons for the school closings is the mayor just wants to do payback to the union as a way of saying we're going to open more charter schools that don't have unions, and more of your members will be out of work, and this is what you'd get for striking. But I think that the union, if you go back to last September, they weren't striking for more pay because that part of their contract had already been settled. They were striking because the public schools in Chicago are severely under-resourced. There are schools that don't have guidance counselors, that don't have librarians, that don't have art anyone to teach art or music classes, and yet there are people sitting on the board of the Chicago school system who send their children to private schools that have all of those things. And they should have enough of a conscience to say, you know, why can't kids in public schools have at least some of the advantages that my own children have? Penny Pritzker, who was just nominated to be Secretary of Commerce by President Obama, was a member of the Chicago Public School Board, and she's the woman who was raising money for a new library at the University of Chicago Lab School, which has lavish facilities, and yet the kids that she's responsible for are going to school in terribly under-resourced schools, particularly where the kids are African-American and Latino. And the other point you mentioned in the opening was that most of the kids affected by the closings are black, about 90% of them, but the enrollment in the public school system is only about 40% African-American. So this is a disparate impact that hits very heavily on the African-American community, closing down neighborhood schools that in many cases have been there for decades, where, you know, someone's mother went, their aunts, their uncles, their grandparents, everyone went to the school. It was a fixture. And now the closing of the neighborhood school will simply accelerate the deterioration of the neighborhood.
I'm Cynthia Schuster, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn today. We're talking about the school closings in Chicago with Diane Ravitch, a research professor of education at New York University and an education historian. We're taking your calls at 1-800-642-1234 and your emails at talk@wpr.org. We'll go to the phones now. We've got Saeed in Green Bay joining us. Hi, Saeed.
Yes, good morning. Thank you so much for having this wonderful guest. Albert Einstein said that the definition of insanity is to do the same thing over and over again, expecting different results. The data on the public school system in our country is dismal. over the past 40 years, we have, on with inflation-adjusted dollars, increased investment in K through 12 education by almost threefold. During that same time period, educational outcomes have not changed or have deteriorated. The principal driver of this essentially cheating of our children from a good education and a good future is a powerful union that has made reform within the public school system impossible. That is the reason why alternatives such as charter choice of the school vouchers, etc., are needed to create a space that is free of unions so that reforms can actually happen. And I disagree with your speaker on the fact that charter schools, it's the schools that choose. I cite the Harlem Success Academy in your speaker's own neighborhood. What Eva Moskowitz has been able to achieve there is remarkable. And they choose their kids from the same demographic, same area as the zone schools, by lottery.
Okay, Saeed, thank you so much.
Okay, thanks. Actually, nothing that you said is accurate. First of all, to say that we are spending more and have no better outcomes is not true. I have a book coming out this September from Knopf, which is a very distinguished publishing house, which contains all the graphs and tables to prove several points. First of all, achievement has never been higher than it is today. It has increased steadily over the past 40 years. It's increased significantly in reading, and it's increased dramatically in mathematics. This is true for white kids, black kids, Asian kids, and Hispanic kids. Achievement is higher. Test score achievement based on federal tests, which are no stakes and which are given every 2 years. And this, from 1970 to today, there has been steady improvement and a tremendous improvement, particularly for black and Hispanic kids. Secondly, high school graduation rates are the highest they've ever been in the history of this country. And they have, in fact, if you look at the, include the population, let's say from 18 to 24, 90% have a high school diploma. We have one of the highest graduation rates in the world. So what you're listening to is a false narrative put out by these so-called reformers who are, in fact, the privatization movement. And the third point is about the dropout. You always hear about the dropout crisis. The dropout rate is at a historical low point. There have never been fewer dropouts than there are today. What we have more of is we have more kids who are poor. We lead the world in poverty, child poverty. We lead at least all the advanced nations of the world. There are some third world countries that have more child poverty than we do. But amongst all the nations that consider themselves to be industrialized advanced nations, we are number one. Almost one out of four children in the United States lives in poverty. And there is a direct, close to a one-to-one correlation between poverty and test scores. Children who come from poverty have the lowest scores. Children who come from affluence have the highest scores. And to blame teachers in public schools for the high poverty rate is ridiculous. Now, Eva Moskowitz's schools do choose their students. They do counsel out kids with special ed. They do not have the same population as the children in the same neighborhood. She gets free space from the city, and her school is run. It's like her critics call it academic apartheid. Her schools have fewer children with disabilities, none with severe disabilities. The school in the same building has many children with disabilities. Her schools have very few English language learners compared to the school in the same building or compared to the same neighborhood. So what you were reciting, unfortunately, is the narrative of the reformers, these so-called reformers. And what their goal is to destroy public education in America. And it's really a terrible thing because public education is a pillar of our democracy, and it has been for almost 200 years. And we are seeing in our lifetime the slow extinction of public education, particularly in big cities, because public schools are being blamed for problems they did not create, and they're struggling to solve them. But frankly, it takes more than the public schools to solve the problems of poverty. And the voucher schools do not outperform public schools. In fact, in many cities, and in those cities where there are voucher schools, they get the same results or worse results. And the charters range dramatically from, you know, some of them are excellent schools, some of them are abysmal schools. And on average, they do not get better results than the public schools. So we will be extinguishing a vital public institution and replacing it with a private sector institution where there will be very little oversight, and the opportunity for fraud and corruption and inflated headcounts is dramatic.
What about Saeed's allegation, though, that the teachers' unions have, in a sense, backed themselves in a corner, creating an environment where reform can't happen otherwise?
Obviously, this is ridiculous because the most unionized states happen to have the highest test scores in the United States. The three highest performing states in the country on the federal test, which, again, where there are no stakes, there can be no cheating, no one knows who's going to take the test. It's random sampling done every other year by a federal agency. The federal test called NAEP shows that the highest performing states are Massachusetts, Connecticut, and New Jersey. Massachusetts leads the pack in everything. Massachusetts is 100% unionized. If unions were the problem and getting rid of them were the answer, then we would look to the states that have right-to-work laws as being the best states in the country. But again, if you look at the NAEP scores, the National Assessment of Educational Progress, the federal test, the right-to-work states are somewhere in the middle or very frequently at the very bottom. You would expect Mississippi and Alabama and Georgia to be leading the pack, North Carolina to be leading the pack. But, of course, they're not, and they're non-union states.
We'll go back to the phones, and Bill in Appleton has been waiting. Hi, Bill.
Hi. I've been listening, and I appreciate the comments that you've been making. My concern in all of this is in the equation is something that doesn't get talked about is the parenting that takes place in the home. I consider myself an educator. I'm a minister. I serve a congregation that is probably considered upper middle class in demographic, economic demographic. I was raised in a middle class household. Back in the 70s, I volunteered while in high school at Head Start. What we have today is a lot of people who are economically secure, and parenting is not taking place in the home, and somehow teachers, administrators, and others in the schools, this responsibility for parenting has been abdicated to them. Thereby, so the interesting issue for me is there are poor, and there are more poor in the United States than there were in many different understandings of what it is to be poor than there were in the 70s. However, the issue permeates through demographic as far as financial ability to buy things. That is, there are people in upper middle class and upper class households where parenting is not taking place, and so let's have the teachers parent and raise our children.
Okay. And what do you say to that, Diane?
Well, I think he's absolutely right that parenting is crucial. And, you know, we have a generation or several generations of studies saying that the single most important impact on how children do in school, whether they study, whether they come to school every day, whether they finish high school, whether they perform well when they're in school, all of those things that we consider outcomes are highly dependent on family. And one way of looking at it is family income, because that's a measure of whether parents have the wherewithal to invest in their children. And there was a study that came out just recently from a guy at Stanford named Sean Reardon. And Sean Reardon said that the biggest gap in this country is not between white children and black children. It's between well-to-do families and children and poor children. And the reason for the gap, as he puts it, is that the better-off parents are able to invest in their children's cognitive development. They themselves are college-educated. They take their kids to the library. They take them to museums. They have conversations at dinner. Frequently, it's a two-parent family. Kids who grow up poor grow up in neighborhoods that are unsafe. They sometimes witness violence. They're more prone to be sick. They're less likely to see a doctor. There are all kinds of... These are not excuses. It's just reality that being poor in America is really, really hard, and one out of four of the kids in this country are living in poverty. So then we turn around and blame the schools. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, all the things that impact on whether children perform well or not start in the home, and we don't have any governmental mechanism for changing that, but I think it would help if we stopped blaming teachers for conditions that they don't control.
Well, are there things that schools and teachers can do together to work with parents to get better outcomes for these kids?
Well, sure, and there actually are ways that government can help and that foundations can help. Right now, the foundations are pouring literally billions into things like teacher evaluation. And despite all these billions that both the government and the foundations have spent, there's yet to be a teacher evaluation scheme that has accurately said who are the good teachers and who are the bad teachers, because usually everybody knows that, and you don't even have to go through all that trouble to identify it. But if you look for ways where schools and families can work together, there are many programs to help where schools actually do that. But there are things that our society ought to be doing. For example, something as simple as prenatal care. Many children who are born to women who never got prenatal care, and they're born with disabilities that will afflict their life for the rest of their lives. And that could be eliminated, again, by a sensible program of making prenatal care available to every pregnant woman. And there, we are 132 in the world in providing good prenatal care to our children. This came from a report done by the March of Dimes a year ago. We're just abysmal at taking care of pregnant women. And then when their children are born with developmental delays, cognitive deficiencies, we pay for it for the rest of their lives.
Hmm. I wouldn't have thought of that. Well, we were talking earlier about evaluating schools and school success, and I'm wondering if there are greater social issues at play that are affecting student performance within the school, how can you evaluate fairly and consider the fact that parenting is an issue, socioeconomic status is an issue. How do you even devise a system that can accurately evaluate success in that way?
Well, you can't really evaluate teachers the way it's being done now. The way it's being done now, and this has been encouraged by Artie Duncan, by Obama's Race to the Top program, the way that it's being done now is to say to states, tie everything to test scores. And if the test scores don't go up, the teacher must be a bad teacher. And that's actually turns out to be a very bad idea, because many of the reasons for the test scores are out beyond the teacher's control.
Right. I guess I'm wondering, is there a way, though, in a perfect world, could you devise a different system, and what would it be?
There is a better system, and there are several districts that have this better system. The best known is Montgomery County, Maryland. They have a program that they've had many years called Peer Assistance and Review. And what it is, it works this way. If a new teacher is hired, they have a mentor. If an old teacher or a veteran teacher is doing poorly and the principal says this teacher is not doing a good job, then that veteran teacher will get a mentor. And the mentors, at the end of a year, will report back to a committee composed of teachers and principals and say, Ms. Jones has really improved, and I recommend, you know, that she continue to be on the payroll, or Ms. Jones needs more help, or Ms. Jones is never going to be a good teacher. We recommend removal. Hmm. And since they put that program into effect, where the mentors are working and their master teachers are working alongside both the new teachers and the struggling veterans, they have fired about 200 teachers, whereas in the past they had never fired anybody. The union in Montgomery County strongly supports the program because it's a fair program. It's not based on test scores. It involves giving people a chance to show what they can do and then helping them. And if they won't be helped, then they're fired.
That's Diane Ravitch. She's a research professor of education at New York University and an education historian. She's a former U.S. Assistant Secretary of Education under President George H.W. Bush, and blogs at dianeravitch.net. We're talking this hour about the decision last week to close 50 public schools in Chicago, whether that's the right approach to tackling some steep budget deficits in that school district, and whether it's a trend that might start picking up across the country, including here in Wisconsin. We're taking your calls at 1-800-642-1234 and your emails at talk@wpr.org. I'm Cynthia Schuster, filling in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Cynthia Schuster, filling in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, talking education reform and the Chicago Public School District with Diane Ravitch, research professor of education at New York University and an education historian. Diane, you were saying that school reform and the school choice movement is overstating the problem with our schools, and it isn't offering good solutions. But why is this movement having so much influence on education policy so far?
Well, I think that it's had tremendous impact because of two things. First of all, it has the support of Bill Gates, and Bill Gates has very many, you know, he's got $30 or $50 billion, and he dispenses a lot of money. So he became very close with Arne Duncan. Arne Duncan is very close with President Obama, and there are just a lot of very wealthy people who want this privatization to proceed. They want public schools closed, charter schools open. Some of them, not all of them, want vouchers. But it's the charter movement has accelerated the voucher movement. The voucher movement was virtually dead until the charter movement took off. And once the Obama administration began supporting choice, then it was really hard to argue against vouchers, because how do you draw the line between one form of choice and another? It's the principle that matters. The principle here is that public education must serve all children, not just the ones that they want, and that we have a very strong tradition of public education as one of the founding stones of our democracy. So you have this weird situation of these people who call themselves reformers who are actually not trying to improve public education, but in most cases to replace it with private sector institutions. And the strongest reason to think that this is going to fail is, first of all, there is no mass base for it at all. They have no popular support. Their organizations are the foundations, and the organizations that the foundations have created, plus the federal government's power and might. But there are many blogs now that are telling the truth, and the truth is the American public doesn't want to privatize its public schools. There was just a stunning election out in Los Angeles where the billionaires put up a candidate who knew nothing. This was the Los Angeles school board race. The billionaires put up a candidate who had worked for the mayor, and the mayor works hand in glove with the elites. So they gave him about $2 million to defeat a teacher, and the teacher had raised about $50,000. So on one hand, you have a teacher with $50,000 who wasn't even supported by her own union. Her union endorsed both candidates. And you have a young politician with $2.2 million, and the teacher won. I mean, there is no public support for this reform movement, the so-called reform movement, once the public understands that its true goal is to take away public education and hand it off to private sector interests.
Well, and applying that to Chicago, the school board there is a mayoral appointed board. So how much influence did the public have on that? And was that an election issue when Rahm Emanuel was running for mayor?
No, Rahm Emanuel did not say that he planned to close down a huge swath of schools in Chicago. And I think that he's going to have a rough re-election when he comes up again in 2 years, because there was a lot of public support for the strike, and you wouldn't have known it just by watching, let's say, Fox News. But from what the polls showed in Chicago, the parents supported the teachers striking, because parents understood that teachers were striking for smaller classes. They were striking for arts teachers and music teachers and for decent conditions of teaching and learning. So I don't think there is this great divide between the union and public. And ironically, the polls in Chicago and the polls in New York show that when the public is asked, who do you trust more, the union or the mayor? The public trusts the union more than they do the mayor, because they know the union is the teachers, and they trust teachers more than they do the mayor. And in both of these cities, the mayor has chosen reliable people who will vote their way and vote unanimously their way and will never ask questions. And we've had these huge public demonstrations in New York, as happened in Chicago, where parents went to the meetings and pleaded, please don't close our school. And at the decisive meeting in Chicago last week, there were parents there again pleading for their schools, and the board took only one vote. It took them, you know, like less time, as one of the critics said, it took them less time to close down 50 schools than it would have taken to boil an egg. They didn't even bother to read their names out loud. One of the speakers, by the way, who came up and protested, she had 2 minutes, and she started reading the names of the schools that would be closed. And they dragged her, literally dragged her away from the microphone, and mm-hmm. she sat on the floor continuing to read the names of the schools that would be closed. And these historic institutions, which meant a lot to their communities, were simply closed with, you know, a wave of the hand by a hand-picked school board.
That's Diane Ravitch, Research Professor of Education at New York University and Education Historian. And we're talking about the decision last week to close 50 public schools in the Chicago area. At least 10 of them are elementary schools.
I think they're all elementary schools.
Are they?
Yep. There are no high schools among them. They're all not even middle schools. They're all elementary schools. And I would again point out that the irony is that three of them were schools that Arne Duncan closed in 2002, and he turned them around and transformed them. And when President-elect Obama came to Chicago in 2008, right after his election, and he announced that he had chosen Arne Duncan, he did it at Dodge Renaissance Academy. Mm-hmm. Dodge Elementary was one of the schools closed by Arne Duncan, and so President Obama came to Dodge Renaissance and said, "This school is an example of Arne Duncan's courage. He, despite the protests of the parents, he closed the school, and look what a great school it is now." That was 2008. Hmm. 2013, Rahm Emanuel School Board just closed Dodge Renaissance Academy.
Yeah, and I did misspeak. It was this closure represents 10% of all elementary schools mm-hmm. in the Chicago district. Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones. We've got Craig in Minneapolis waiting. Hi, Craig.
Hello. As the conversation goes, I've kind of changed what I'm going to say just a little bit. Our conversation is like pointing out what the real problem that we have is. We aren't focusing on what the real problem is. Everybody from both sides are manipulating data and facts to support the position that they want to take. Your guest is saying a school board member in a small school board in California gets elected over a big corporate guy means that the public doesn't support that avenue, that they support the teachers and the unions.
Los Angeles is not a small school district. It's the second largest school district in America.
Here's the deal, lady. It's just as easy to say that what happened in Wisconsin when they tried to recall Walker means that the public doesn't support the teachers or the unions either. Neither one of those things are the problem. Doesn't matter what you throw at it, what you do, how much money you take, until you deal with the fact that if the students don't care, you can't educate them. That's the problem. The students don't care. And you try to tie it to poverty and say that that people are in poverty and therefore they get low test scores. I'm saying people are in poverty because they don't care.
Diane, what do you say to that?
Well, I find that, I certainly think it's important that students care. And if you look at test scores, whether it's the NAEPs, the national scores, or the international scores, the one most reliable predictor of high scores or low scores is family income. So it seems as though if you come from a rich family, you care more. I don't think that's the truth. I think the truth is that if you come from a wealthy family, you have college-educated parents, you have a larger vocabulary, you have better health care, and when you get to school, you're ready to learn, as opposed to what happens if you don't have any of those advantages. So, yes, poverty does matter. And if test scores are your measure, then poverty matters a great deal. I think it matters for other reasons. I think it's just a matter of having a decent society where people do have an equal educational opportunity.
Let's go next to Judith in Muskego. Hi, Judith.
Hello. My understanding about the data that was used to close the schools was not accurate. My understanding is that these schools, it was a function of their outcomes and their poverty level. And the poverty level was a lot lower than it should have been. And they're using faulty data to support their rationale to close the school. And I got that information from someone who works within the Chicago public school system who deals with the data.
And can you speak to that, Diane?
Well, I have no doubt that the data was faulty because I've read and talked to people in Chicago who say that there were some very, very good schools and some high-functioning schools that were closed. Most of the schools were schools in the heart of the black community. And nobody's quite sure where those kids will go. Some of the schools serve children with autism. and no one's sure where those kids will go. Some of them had special programs for deaf children. No one's sure what will happen to them. I mean, what really matters is not whether the data was flawed or good. What matters is that a school board has a responsibility to improve schools, and you don't improve schools by closing them. That, to me, that's the bottom line. This is not school reform. And if they say, well, we don't, it's not about school reform, it's about saving money, then they're really, I think, defaulting on their responsibility as school board members, because if they were acting responsibly, they would have gone to the state legislature and said, we need enough funding to keep our schools open. We cannot close down public education because of a lack of money. And that's happening now in Michigan, where there are entire school districts that are being closed down and turned over to for-profit operators because the state simply doesn't want to pay the cost of operating them at the same time that it's giving out huge tax breaks. I think Wisconsin's in terrible trouble because of Scott Walker's hostility to public education, and you're going to see a lot of the same problems and the same solutions that are now destroying public education in other cities and states visited on you in Wisconsin.
Let's go next to Carl in Madison. Hi, Carl.
Yes, hello. It's a very interesting and important topic this hour. I feel that the opponents of public schooling are similar to the opponents of most public institutions. First, you defame it, and then you defund it, and then you privatize it. And with such a wonderful and rich history of public schooling in the United States, we really haven't had the experience of breaking it and then trying to building it again later. And I was curious the guest's, Diane Ravitch's, thoughts on once this, you know, process is pretty scrambled and pretty disrupted by current attempts to really damage public schooling, what is the likelihood that we'll be able to build anything like what we've had in the past in the future?
I think that it's going to be, at some point in the future, we're going to have better leaders. I mean, this is really ultimately a political problem. We have right now a national administration that works, very closely with those who support privatization. I get the impression that President Obama and Arne Duncan prefer charter schools to public schools, and that they love the idea, as the business people, a lot of business people involved here, they love the idea of creative disruption. Well, there's nothing creative about destroying a public school, because in many cases you're taking the heart, ripping the heart right out of a community and then scattering the kids to the four winds to go and find some school that will accept them, or opening a charter school that will take some but not all of them. So it's going to take tremendous political leadership to have a president and to have governors and state legislatures say, this is a terrible mistake. We cannot do to the schools what we've done, or what we've done to hospitals and to prisons, where private sector interests take over the institution, and the first thing they do is they cut costs because they don't want experienced people. They want newcomers. They want to keep the costs as low as possible. And another way to cut costs is to not serve the kids with the highest needs. So, yes, they will keep some public schools, and they will be the dumping grounds. And this is what will happen. The charters and the vouchers will take the high-performing kids in the poorest communities, and also in middle-class and middle-income communities, and the kids with high needs will be left to the dumping ground schools, and that will be the public schools. This is a resurrection of what we used to call a dual school system, and this would be a tragedy for America. And this is why I think it's so important for the public to understand what the game plan is, and the game plan is privatization, just as it is has been in every other public every other part of the public sector. And it never ends up saving money. It ends up costing more money.
Well, in our last minute, a court hearing's been set for July 16th in Chicago to decide whether or not to stop the school closures there. What do you think concerned parents and teachers need to do in order for their fight to be successful?
Well, I certainly hope they win in court, because there's no question that there's a disparate impact on, first of all, on African-American children who are targeted in these school closures. And secondly, there's a disparate impact on children with special needs that who have individualized education plans. The goal of the school board is to cut costs by putting everyone into larger classes, and this is going to mean worse education for everybody. So I think at this point there are several routes to reverse this. One is to win in the courts, and the other is to do what the Chicago Teachers Union is doing, and that is to have a voter registration drive so that the people who are most affected will have their voices heard. This is a democracy, and we can't afford to allow small elites to take it over simply because they have more money.
Well, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you so much for being with us this hour, Diane.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Our guest was Diane Ravitch, Research Professor of Education at New York University and an education historian. She's a former U.S. Assistant Secretary of Education under President George H.W. Bush. You can read her blog at dianeravitch.net, where she comments on a lot of the education news coming out from across the country, including in Chicago. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for on-air production and KP Whaley for producing this hour. Rob Ferret was our on-air director. You can find archives of this program at WPR.org/Kathleen. And you can also leave your comments and continue the conversation over at the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Kathleen Dunn right here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.